Hi, this is Ken McCarthy, and welcome. Today we're going to talk about a book, but more important than a book, we're going to talk about it's hard to even put this in words, a radical new idea, an important breakthrough in scientific thinking. There's a lot of labels I could put on this, but I consider this a huge thing that we're going to be talking about today, and I'm glad who's on this call is on it. I think you're going to find it enlightening, interesting. It's definitely going to make you think, and it's probably going to change your view of the world and the universe that you live in. Welcome, Perry Marshall, our guest today.
Hey, it's great to be on. It's an honor to be on. It's always an honor to be on a Ken McCarthy interview, so thank you.
You're welcome. We're really, really glad to have you talk about this. Let's talk about, first the title of your book and where people can get it, and then we'll get into the meat of our conversation.
The title of my book is called Evolution 2.0, Breaking the Deadlock Between Darwin and Design, and it's on Amazon, and it's released on September 1st. It's on pre-order now. And I also have a website, cosmicfingerprints.com, that has a lot of supplemental material. So,
great. Cosmicfingerprints.com. And
that's right.
And the name of the book is Evolution 2.0. Now,
yes.
Somewhere in your book, I don't have it in front of me because I'm on the road at the moment, there's a pie diagram that shows the relative percentages of people who believe different things about how this whole universe that we're in came to be. And correct me if I'm wrong, but roughly when we're talking about America, about a third have a creationist philosophy or belief.
Mm-hmm.
A third have what we would call a neo-Darwin belief. And a third are like, heck, I don't know.
Yeah, that's about right. That's about right. Yes.
So let me tell you where I fall on this, and then let's jump into the discussion. I'm also going to give a little bio of Perry too. But I was raised as a Catholic in the sense that we went to church every Sunday, and every now and then I had to go through some ritual like First Communion and confession and I don't know, all these other things.
Uh-huh.
And but my most religious experience as a little kid was falling asleep in church. This happened a lot. This happened more than once. I would wake up, maybe it was because of the setting, I would look around, I would think about the church, the people in it, the town, the buildings, the trees, the sky, the plant, and I go, where did all this stuff come from?
Yeah.
And I was just always baffled by that. Now, in the faith that I grew up in, there really wasn't any push for us to believe creation one way or the other. You know,
yes, Catholics usually aren't real big on that.
Yeah, it wasn't a big deal. So as I looked at the debate, creationism seemed to me to be an utter oversimplification and dumbing down of God. I just couldn't believe that the guy just waved a wand and all of a sudden all this stuff was here. There had to be a lot more. He had to have more, oomph than that. And
yeah.
the Darwinist stuff always seemed like lunacy to me. I mean, really, we just threw some chemicals in a hot bath, and next thing you know, we've got giraffes and elephants. And I'm sorry, I just can't see that either. But
right?
I didn't have an answer. So
yeah.
Along comes Perry Marshall. Now, Perry was raised in a family that did believe in creationism.
Yes.
I don't know if it's an ism.
Yeah, it's an ism.
It's an ism. And specifically the young creationism side, which says this whole place is about, 6,000 years old?
Yeah, that's what they, man, I remember like when they sent the guy to our church and he gave like the whole, however many, I think he was there for like 4 days and, Sunday morning, Sunday night, Monday night, Tuesday night. And, we got the whole story about, the flood explains all the fossils and all of that. Yeah.
So they weren't fooling around.
No, they weren't fooling around.
So, and all this would have probably gone fine, I guess, except for two things. One, Perry got a degree in electrical engineering.
Yep.
And two, Perry is really serious about getting to the truth of things, more serious than the average person. And along the way, he used his degree helping automate very elaborate and expensive to operate factories where if you were down for a minute, it's like $15,000 a minute loss if your systems don't work.
Yeah.
So, real world stuff. He also was the guy that really sorted out the practicality of how AdWords worked. You know, Google launched it, and as Google often does, did absolutely nothing to explain how the thing worked or why you would want to use it or, you know, anything. And Perry was the first guy to say, let's look under the hood and see how this thing works, and does it make any sense, and should we do it? And it was a very pioneering move at the time. I'm proud to say I took a no small role in that. I gave Perry his first chance to present this to a group of internet marketers.
Yeah.
Anyway, this was
big deal.
Yeah, this was explosively important information to a whole world of business owners and entrepreneurs. But unbeknownst to me, at the very same time that Perry was doing that, he got caught afire to try to figure out this, where did this all this stuff come from question. And I want to talk a little bit about the method that you used to get the understanding that you have. First of all, you were not looking for a new ideology. You
no.
Didn't switch one set of unexamined beliefs for another set of examined beliefs. So you kind of, in addition to doing a massive amount of reading and studying and talking, you also threw yourself into the lion's den of the internet. And I find the story of how you honed these ideas or these insights or these questions, because they're really still in the realm of question. I just find this whole story fascinating. So could you tell a little bit about what you did in addition to the norm? Because we all read, we all watch videos, we all talk to people, but you took it another step further, which I think everybody should listen up, because if you want to form an argument or form an understanding, I think Perry has blazed the trail for the way to do it. So could you tell that story?
Yeah, so this whole thing started with an argument with my brother who had gone. So he had like been on the bandwagon even more than me, like quite a bit more than me as far as towing the religious line. I've always explored a lot of things, and I would say my spiritual beliefs were more fluid than his. But, I mean, he was like on the party line, and he was actually a missionary in China for 4 years, but when he came home, he was almost an atheist. And one of the reasons why is because he is very, very smart, very probing, very penetrating, and he just started realizing that at the very least, we could say the picture of God that he had been given was a little like what you described, like a little too small, a little too narrow. But he's very smart, and he was dragging me with him, and this turned into an argument, and this argument was actually going on for a couple of years, and I mean, he was just, and you know, I can't ignore a good question. I just can't do it, and I really found myself, as I grew more and more uncomfortable, I found myself retreating to what I knew best, which was actually engineering. And it was like I looked at hand at my into my arm and I said, This is one incredible piece of engineering. Like, you know, think, right. You know, you're carrying a suitcase, you're drinking a Slurpee, you're driving your car, you're on your phone, like all the things our hands can do. And I say this, you know, like you don't just believe this happened accidentally, do you? And he was ready for that because he had already kind of flipped over to the other side. And he basically gives me the Darwinian story. And, you know, very quickly, without even having to go that far into the conversation, I knew that there was lots of biologists that didn't really buy into the design argument.
Mm-hmm.
I knew I was a designer, and I looked at things through that lens. And so I saw design in my hand, but I knew lots of people would disagree, and I knew that I didn't really know.
Got it.
I don't know. I have a way I think the world is, but one thing I learned in engineering was how counterintuitive some things are. There are a lot of things in engineering that you would never believe until you spent 3 hours getting a full explanation.
Uh-huh.
And look, Ken, lots of things in business are that way. Lots of things
sure.
in the stock market or anything. There's the surface way of looking at it, and then there's the people that understand it deeply. And not only is there the deep understanding, there's the guy that's not put in his 10,000 hours, he's actually put in his 30,000 hours, and then he has a big epiphany, and then it turns everything upside down, and now he's got another new understanding, right? And this is how pursuit of wisdom is. And I said, you know what? I've got all these questions, and I had a lot of questions in a lot of departments. And I said, I know engineering. I know science. I'm going to let science answer this question for me. You know, can you get a design without a designer? Because if you can, then there's a bunch of stuff the biologists apparently know that they never taught me in engineering school.
Right, because you know, we're all busy making things, and you know what's involved in making something that actually functions and works.
No kidding.
And so now we're supposed to believe that either someone may have waved a magic wand and all these things just came to be out of nothing, or that a bunch of, you know, randomly colliding molecules develop the human hand, the human eye, the giraffe, the dandelion, and all these beautifully functioning, these just magnificently, exquisitely, beautifully functioning things.
Yeah.
And it just, we threw some billiard balls around, and we put 1,000 monkeys in a room, and then they came up with Hamlet.
Right.
Really?
Yeah.
Does that really happen? That doesn't make sense.
And specifically, it was the idea that natural selection, which is kind of an abstract concept, really, but the idea that natural selection could force Shakespeare out of monkeys. Really? Like, I've never seen that work. I don't know anybody that writes software that way. I don't know anybody that designs anything that way. Right? And I said, I am going to get to the bottom of this. So I floundered for a while. It was very uncomfortable. I've got this belief system, I've got this family, I've got this, it seems to work pretty well, but if I find out it's all a hoax, I'm not going to be able to, like, sit at Thanksgiving dinner and just agree with everybody. Like, mm-hmm. you know, this is going to be a major disruption if I find out that the only intellectually honest thing to do is be an atheist. But I said, you know what? I'm going to follow the evidence where it leads, and I'm going to get to the bottom of this. And so I started digging, and like I said, I floundered for quite a while. But I there was a point where suddenly my feet touched the bottom of the swimming pool, and I knew that I was onto something that I could work with. And it was when I was looking up stuff about DNA mutations, because allegedly those are the things that provide the raw material for evolution to happen. And I suddenly realized I had written an Ethernet book in 2002 in a different career. You can still buy it. It's called Industrial Ethernet, How the Ones and Zeros Go Across the Wire. And I realized that the data structure in DNA is scary similar to the data structure in Internet packets. Like, unbelievably scary similar, with lots of parallels, like not just a few. In fact, really, all of the same basic principles were identical. Oh, I get it. Now I know how to break this down. Evolution is a software engineering problem.
Aha. Okay.
Okay? It's code. It's not like code. It is code. Okay?
So DNA is code.
It is literally, not metaphorically. It's not just some kind of analogy. It is literally code. The only difference is, not the only difference, but one of the main differences is computer code is a 2-bit system, and DNA code is a 4-bit system. Mm-hmm. But that's, you know, 2 letters, 4 letters. Other than that, it's the same basic idea. And I found out, and it really started getting interesting. So most people never even think about this, but...
Including, by the way, a whole lot of scientists.
Including a lot of scientists. But, okay, think about a dropped cell phone call. You know, that could be, or like a text message that you never get, or a garbled, you know, you get a garbled piece of something, and you don't know what it is. That could be from one bit that got corrupted. And one thing you know, if you happen to write an Ethernet book, is that at every step of the way, an unbelievable number of steps. There's another stage of error detection and error correction, and please resend that message. It didn't come through. In fact, probably two-thirds of all the bandwidth on the Internet is consumed by the error detection and the error correction.
Gotcha.
Okay, because
one tiny error at any level could scramble the whole ultimate message.
It really does. It can scramble the whole thing, okay? And so two-thirds of your cell phone data bill is error correction, actually. Okay? This is the truth. And okay. I said, you know, even if, okay, let's set aside for a second where the first bacteria came from. The only way that it could still be going 3 billion years later is if there is a tremendous amount of error detection and error correction. I knew this had to be true.
Mm-hmm.
So I started looking for this, and I found a giant subset of biological literature and discoveries that actually started to make sense of where evolution actually comes from. And it doesn't come from copying errors, okay? So, like, if you read a simple, standard high school textbook, college textbook, entry level, anything about evolution, if it's the usual secular story, they will almost always tell you creatures are replicating, replication errors occur, occasionally the errors are better, natural selection selects the better ones, you get evolution.
Right, and that's the key point, if you don't mind, I want to make sure everybody grasps this, is the whole basis of neo-Darwinist evolution is that errors, that coding errors, mutations, are the basis of progress.
Right.
And you just, in your book, you just so clearly demolish that.
Yeah,
possible.
And when you hear that story, they always emphasize the natural selection part.
Right.
Well, Ken, let me give you another name for natural selection, 80-20.
Okay.
Okay? Natural selection says that if one creature is 0.1% better than the other one, it will eventually completely swamp out the inferior one and take over.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? It's like it only needs to be 0.1% better, and you'll get 10 times more of them. That's what natural selection says. Natural selection is very powerful, but it can only select it if it exists. Natural selection all by itself can't make anything. Okay?
Exactly.
So it doesn't
exactly
explain anything. And then the thing, so people believe that a copying error could make your eye better, or it could make your hand better, or it could make a new species over if it happened enough times in a row, and they don't have any conception that the statistics against that are so massively stacked against it that is quite literally impossible. It's not just improbable, it's impossible, and a communication engineer knows this.
And let's talk about one of the proofs that you showed is the fruit fly experiments,
mm-hmm.
where they were trying to replicate this idea of, you know, accidental random mutation creates a better fruit fly. They did this experiment a gazillion times, and what did they find out?
So I as soon as I got to what I just described, I said, okay, so there must be experiments where they accelerated the copying errors and sped up evolution. So where are they? And I very easily found them. And they are fruit fly radiation experiments from basically the 1890s to probably the 1940s. There was a ton of people doing this, and they can very easily do it. They just get, they either get some chemical or they get a little bit of nuclear radiation, and they put it in a jar of fruit flies, and away they go. And they tried this for decades, and they didn't get any better fruit flies. They got fruit flies with legs growing out of their head. They got all kinds of bizarre mutants. They got funny colored eyes. Now, in the process of this, they learned a great deal about the fruit fly genome because they found out, well, if we sequence the DNA and we see we can correlate the birth defect to what part of the DNA got damaged, and then we know what protein or what segment of DNA codes for a leg or a wing. And they learned that, but they didn't get evolution. They got de-evolution. Okay, and this is really important, and it confirmed everything I knew as a communications engineer. Like, of course it never worked. It couldn't. There's no possibility that it could work. But then I discovered like a major ding-a-ling-a-ling-a-ling, like massive discovery is there was a lady named Barbara McClintock, and she did a bunch of experiments with corn. And she was doing radiation too, but she was thinking like a hacker, and she was extremely adept. She was a tremendous geneticist, and she said, "Okay, I'm going to carefully control this, and I'm going to put the plant in a situation where it can't reproduce without, you know, changing something. I'm going to see what happens." And the plant, like, so she threw the plant a curveball, and the plant threw a curveball right back at her.
Hmm.
And what happened was she damaged part of the plant's chromosome so that it could not reproduce, and it flipped the plant into, I would liken this to safe mode on a Windows computer, like where it got shut down wrong, and then it starts up, and then it goes through this process. The plant started repairing, going through a series of cycles and repairing its DNA, and eventually grabbed another part of DNA from a different chromosome, patched the broken chromosome with some new code that was different but acceptable, and began to reproduce, and it had different characteristics than the plants did before.
Did it happen in the lifetime of that plant, or was it?
Yes, it happened in real time.
Wow. So self-repairing.
It self-repaired. Not only self-repaired, it innovated. So what I just described to you would be like if somebody ripped the page out of a novel and a program figured out, based on all of the other things before and after it, what was missing, and then took paragraphs from other pages and pieced them together and stuck them in that page and made it so you couldn't tell that the page had ever been ripped out. That is what Barbara McClintock discovered.
And a plant did this at the DNA level by itself without the help of any genetic engineers or any external forces. It
yes.
was happening within at the level of the DNA.
Yes, and this was at Cold Spring Harbor in New York, and she gave a symposium, and she explained what she had discovered, and mm-hmm. the reaction she got was a mixture of laughter and anger.
Mm-hmm.
It was
mm-hmm.
basically like, you do not actually expect educated people to believe that this just happened, do you?
Wow.
Okay.
Now where did this? Now where did she and this idea ultimately end up, though? Was she a peripheral figure that really was not involved in mainstream science? Was she unrecognized?
That was 1944.
Okay.
And she won the Nobel Prize in 1983.
Oh, okay.
Okay. It took a long time for her to vindicate herself.
Mm-hmm.
But, for example, James Shapiro in 1968 discovered that bacteria can do the same thing. And then in the 70s, they started discovering more and more of this. And what the plant did is called transposition.
Okay.
And anybody who's ever written Google ads or Facebook ads or anything like that and done any kind of testing knows exactly what I'm talking about. So one of the early classic examples in my early Google books was this example where you wrote a Google ad and it got a 0.1% click-through rate, which is terrible, and then we reversed line 2 and line 3 and it went up to like 3.5%, which is great, and all they did was transpose 2 lines of text. Okay, now I did this before I ever got into this evolution stuff, but a person who does Google ads actually understands evolution better than 99% of all the other people in the world, and you don't even know it.
And maybe even some evolutionary science teachers in school.
Yes. Yes. If you've done Google AdWords, you understand that you have to write a letter, an ad. You rack your brain trying to figure out exactly what to say to the exact right person. And then you throw it into the Google natural selection machine,
mm-hmm.
where a 0.1% improvement could get you 10 times more traffic than the next guy, right? And then you have to keep mutating your ads in order to make them better and better.
And your ads, by the way, for people that aren't familiar with the details of what we're talking about, 4 short lines. That's all you've got to work with.
Yeah.
So you move one line here, you move one line there, you change a word on that line. You know, it's a perfect science experiment because you're really getting real world feedback and you're seeing exactly how your changes are affecting the response of the world.
It's a beautiful thing, and it's taken over. And now, like, this is the rules. This is how you do it. And everybody kind of knows it on the internet. Well, it turns out that the exact same process that you use to write, rewrite, re-engineer, rethink, reconceptualize your Google Ads, your landing pages, message to market match, all that stuff is directly and exactly analogous to how organisms adapt in order to evolve. Okay? So just about every cell in existence has the ability to do what Barbara McClintock observed, which is cut, splice, rearrange DNA based on sensory inputs from hundreds of things in the environment.
Mm-hmm.
And Barbara McClintock is famous for asking the question, what does a cell know about itself?
Mm. And then we usually think of cells, oh, it's just a little blob of goop. It's got no brain. It's got no intelligence. It's very unsophisticated. And when you put a bunch of them together, then you get something real happening.
Right. And that is completely backwards. I think the cell itself is more impressive than the larger structures that millions and billions of them make.
Wow, and you cover that very well in your book, and it takes a little bit of explaining to describe how amazing cells are, and how they slice and dice and manipulate and adopt and borrow and integrate functions from other cells, and it's just amazing stuff. So if we take this back, then from a creation point of view, creation is literally an ongoing thing going on all the time, and it's being driven by this code. And what is code? Code is a set of instructions.
Yeah.
Do this, do that, make this, make that. So this, whatever this creation thing is, it's wired into life, and it's going on all the time.
Yeah.
And it's definitely not happening as a result of random mutations.
No.
Like throwing the dice a million times and hoping they're going to stack up on each other and do the hula hoop. I mean, it's just, the hula dance. It's not going to, that certain things are not going to happen, and one of them is random mutations leading to something functional.
Cells have very elaborate checkpoint and error correction functions at multiple levels. And so what was going on was the plant detected an error, multiple errors, and because the errors were so severe, it flipped it into a different mode of operation where it actually started. So this doesn't happen all the time. Normally, this is sitting dormant,
mm-hmm.
but she managed to flip the editing machinery on, okay, and see something that nobody else had ever seen. And cells do this when they're under threat. And so starving bacteria, the mutation rate will go up by a factor of literally 100,000. And they will start furiously rearranging things, trying to see if they can figure out how to digest this other compound that's in the soup that they don't currently have the ability to digest in. And a few of them will figure it out, and then all of a sudden you have mutated bacteria. They also exchange DNA with each other. So, for example, Ken, when you're sick, you got strep, doctor gives the antibiotics, and he always says, Ken, you have to finish the whole bottle.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Right.
Now, the reason is because if you don't kill him dead, here's what's going to happen. So that strep cell is floating around, and it's trying to kill you. It's trying to multiply and everything. There's antibiotic in your bloodstream. That's poison. It's leaking in its cell wall. That thing says, if I don't pump this poison out, I'm dead. Where's a pump? Where do I find a pump? Okay, well, most cells have something called a plasmid, and a plasmid is a Dropbox folder for sharing DNA. It has a copy of its DNA for the purpose of sharing with other cells. It's like a big open source code thing, okay? That strep goes around and it goes, hey, I just found a cell that has a pump, pulls in that DNA, reads it, finds the part that codes for a pump, splices that into its DNA, reads the code, builds a pump, updates its Dropbox folder with new code that has pumps, replicates daughter cells that have pumps, pumps the poison out, and kills you.
Wow.
And this happens in 30 minutes.
Wow. Wow. And again, we want to stress that this is not the cells just doing, you know, hey, random stuff. It's in reaction to specific challenges, and it's, quote, purposeful, unquote.
It's,
right? I mean,
by any reasonable interpretation of what you see going in front, yes.
Okay.
It's purposeful.
Wow. Wow.
And so now here's the thing, Ken. None of this is new or controversial or anything. It's just nobody's heard about it. Like, I really have to emphasize, I did not invent anything here. There's no brand new theory. Everything I'm talking about has been known for decades, and any competent biologist knows it.
Mm-hmm.
But here's how it seems to work, as best I can tell. You go to freshman biology, they teach you about evolution, they indoctrinate you with the idea that it's random and purposeless, and that it's basically based on copying errors. Then when you're a sophomore or a junior, you actually start to find out all of these mechanisms like horizontal gene transfer and transposition and epigenetics, but they've already told you it's random and purposeless, and then you just take for granted that random purposeless changes are going to be useful, and most people never question it after that.
And in fact, if you do question it, there's a whole world of people that will get quite angry.
Yes, and they will stamp you out. And
if you just think of the logic, I mean, where on earth does random purposefulness changes ever improve anything? I mean,
they don't.
I need more money. Well, I'll stand on my head and learn Swahili. Well, that's not going to really do it.
Exactly. And so, like, cells do not get better by standing on their head and learning Swahili. There's something very intentional going on here. And eventually, as I went through this, I said, you know what? I suspect that every technological innovation that Silicon Valley is trying to figure out right now is probably already been answered in a cell somewhere.
Mm. Wow. Wow.
It's literally under our nose. It might be in our nose. Like, the secrets of the universe might be in a booger in your nose and you don't even know it. I mean, I'm completely serious.
You know? No, I know you are. No, I know you are, because we so, and this has always been my argument against creationism or Darwinism, we so disrespect the miracle of life when we think it was created by, you know, a magic wand, or it was, and it's just this random thing, you know, some amino acids, lightning struck it, you know, and a tadpole appeared and, you know, now we have life, you know. It's like,
right.
are you kidding me?
Right?
We can't even figure out the one weed in our backyard if we were really to study it. We would spend 10 years, 1,000 people, and we'd barely scratch the surface of one little plant.
Well, this has serious consequences, too, and I'll give you an example. Cancer, 50% of the time, cancer cells have a deleted gene, and that gene is the kill switch for copying error abort operation.
Mm.
Okay? So it's called apoptosis. It's which is programmed cell death. There is a whole mechanism that says if this cell is copied incorrectly, if the DNA has a bunch of errors and we can't fix them because it will try to fix them, if we can't fix them, then flush, kill it and flush it out.
Which is a really good, nice, elegant system.
Right, right. And it's used in a bunch of different ways. In fact, as embryos develop, the skin between the fingers is programmed to die to create the space between the fingers after the bones have developed.
Oh.
Okay? So okay. The programmed cell death is used in a bunch of places in a bunch of ways, and it shows that cells are obeying marching orders from a larger systemic viewpoint. But cancer cells have had that deleted. And so now, number one, they are replicating unstoppably.
Mm.
But here's the other thing. They are evolving intentionally.
Mm.
So the body tries to fight the cancer cell. Like, hey, you guys stop it. You're not obeying orders. Their evolutionary machinery switches on, and they're like, yeah, you go ahead and try to kill me. I'm going to change this. I'm going to change that. So when somebody's taking chemo or somebody's in any kind of cancer treatment, you are fighting an intelligent disease.
Mm.
Now, Ken, you've studied enough history to know what happens when you underestimate your opponent in war.
Yeah, you can spend all the money you want. You can drop all the bombs you want, and it ain't going to work out for you.
Yeah, and frankly, you'll just kill your own soldiers.
Yeah, yeah, ultimately, yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, we will never solve cancer until we have a proper respect for life and a respect for what evolution actually is and what it consists of. Evolution is, okay, so think about this, Ken. Does anybody have an algorithm where you take somebody's software program, stick it in the algorithm, and the algorithm will debug it and make it better?
No, but if you had that, you'd make Bill Gates look like a pauper.
Well, exactly. Well, that's what evolution is. Evolution is an algorithm that systematically and predictably makes things better and better and better, and it's built into cells. I barely fathom how it works. I only know the vague outlines of what it does. I've tried to explain it as best I can understand it in my book, which is just the tiniest sliver of the tip of the iceberg, but that is what it does, and that is what it is, and it is so mind-blowingly amazing. Oh, my word.
And your book not only lays this out, and by the way, it's very readable if you're science phobic, and some people are. I am sometimes. I can't read every science book that's been written, that's for sure. But this really, just the way Perry's been explaining it, he just lays everything out step by step. Everything is in clear, simple language, one thing adding on to another. And if nothing else, by the time you're at the end of this book, you're going to know more about biology and genetics and electrical engineering principles and information theory than many, many people that teach these things for a living. But you're also going to have a renewed, because we all were born with it, and if you see a little baby, they're fascinated by everything going on.
Yeah.
You're going to have a renewed sense of wonder about this thing that we are living in the middle of, which is still inexplicable. But at least now we know what it's not. We know where it didn't come from.
Right.
Now, you've got something in your book that makes your book quite unique. You're backing up. You're sort of putting your money where your mouth is.
Oh, yeah.
Where you've offered a prize.
Yes.
A pretty big prize.
So one of the very first things that I came to realize, back to the whole Ethernet code thing was, you know, there's like a million codes out there. There's HTML and PHP and postal codes and bar codes and QR codes and every kind of code you can think of. Well, there's like a million of them, and 999,999 are designed by humans. And I used to work for a company that invents codes. Like, okay, you need a communication protocol? We'll come up with one for you.
Mm-hmm.
And there's one code, and we don't know where it came from, and it's called DNA.
DNA, right?
And it's more impressive than all the other codes. I can assure you that. We don't know where it came from, and so my logic was, well, all the other codes we know the origin of are designed, so therefore the implication, the suggestion, the inference is that DNA is also designed. Now, that's an inference. I can't prove it. Now, so I argued and debated this, and, you know, you were asking me, I took all these ideas and I went in my website, Cosmic Fingerprints, and discussion boards and places, and all of this stuff, I duked it out with people who disagreed with me and learned more than you can imagine by having, because I really believe in the dialectic. I really believe in thesis, antithesis, synthesis. I totally believe that. I believe that you must challenge your assumptions. You must let people pound on them. And so I came to a realization. I can say, therefore, you know, therefore DNA is designed, therefore God exists, case closed. I could say that. But what I really need to do is honor the scientist who thinks they might have an answer. It's a scientist's job to look for natural processes and peel the onion another layer deep, another layer deep, another layer deep. And so I have a technology prize for origin of information. If you can produce a code without designing one and without cheating, that would be a major, major, major scientific discovery. It would be as important as quantum mechanics or the discovery of DNA or anything like that. And so I organized a group of private equity investors, and here's how it works. If you can solve it, and it for under any circumstances, the person who discovers it, I will personally write them a check for $100,000 and shake your hand. Okay. But if you discover it and it's patentable, if it's defensibly patentable, my investment group will buy the patents from you for $3 million once the patent's granted, and will pay for the patent process.
Wow.
Okay. And I'm looking to increase the amount, but right now it's at $3 million. And you know, and again, like, is there design in the universe? Absolutely there is. I, you know, intuitively people believe that. They have to be educated out of it with a lot of misleading information in order to believe otherwise. But we must always honor science and scientists in the process of discovery. And what really, okay, I have to just be frank with you, Ken. I'm an electrical engineer. I'm very comfortable with some parts of science. And as I began to kind of get this sorted out, I got very pissed at both sides. Okay? I got very pissed. I know I'm going to offend some people. Brother, I love you. Just be patient with me. At the young earth creationists who, in trying to cram all the mysteries of the universe into a literal interpretation of Genesis 1 and 2, which it doesn't really, that doesn't even do the text justice. It's not what it's trying to do. You know, they try to squash everything down to that size, okay? And they make up their own version of science to make it work, and it really pissed me off. But then on the other side, it really pissed me off that anybody could even think that random copying errors are the difference between, you know, fighting the antibiotic and not fighting the antibiotic, because any communication engineer knows that's lunacy. Mm-hmm. And I started seeing more and more clearly how people on both extremes were abusing science badly and teaching people something that's completely useless. You know, traditional Darwinism, just like the way you read it in a ninth grade science textbook, is completely useless. It doesn't teach you how to do anything useful.
And it's more, it's in the realm of ideology as opposed to science.
Right. It's just a there was a worm pond, there was some lightning, and then the copying errors made things better and better, and here we are. That is, it's wrong scientifically. It is also culturally culturally and philosophically so impoverished.
Absolutely.
What a crappy story to live your life out of. We are here because of a lightning strike and a bunch of random accidents. Well, sure, I'll get a job working for the post office and drink every night if I believe that.
Right.
Oh my!
Nothing matters, and you know, there's nothing magical. There's nothing impressive about anything.
Right.
There's no chance for breakthroughs. There's no chance for evolutionary leaps. It's all just, you know, a bunch of random stuff, and whatever happened in the past is what's going to be the future, and just
right.
Deal with it. Which actually
right.
serves certain people's agendas for, if you have the mass of people thinking that, that's actually very convenient.
Yes.
If you have a plan that involves people not thinking very clearly.
And then on top of that, Ken, the people who believe it's all random and purposeless have now announced we are going to take over our own evolution. We're going to genetically modify everything, and we're going to create a utopia. That's the next thing that, you know, like, oh, dear, like, here we go.
And I'll give my two cents on this very briefly, and then we'll go back. What's really happening, in my view of it, is certain companies like Monsanto are just vandalizing existing genetics so that they can turn it into a product that they control. And so that they can sell more weed killer. It's not as hard. You don't have to dig very deep to
right.
find out that they don't really have any other goal than that. And all this nonsense that this is cutting edge science and brilliant thinking is delusional, in my opinion. But I'm going to get off that soapbox. But let's get back to the prize. I could use an extra $3 million. So what do I do? How do I win the prize again? I've got a what?
I wrote an engineering specification for this. And it's at naturalcode.org.
Okay.
And it's written at a college level. I don't know any simpler way to do it, but it basically says if you can, without cheating, like by, if you could pour chemicals in your bathtub and if they were the right chemicals and you stir them around and you have the right lightning strike and form encoders, codes, and decoders, because you need three things for communication to exist. An encoder, a code, and a decoder. If you can get that to form through some natural process without intelligence getting snuck in somewhere, then we'll write you a check for $100K, and if it's patentable, you get the whole $3 million.
Wow. My understanding is you also, in addition to your $3 million payday or more, as you raise more funds, the discoverer of this or the developer of it also gets an equity position in the patent. Is that correct?
Yes, they do. Yes, they do. Yeah, I mean, don't you figure that person, if the thing ends up being worth $1 billion, don't you think that person would want a piece of the action? Yes, they will get a piece of the action. So, like, I'm quite serious about this. And, you know, and some of my backers, they said, you know, Perry, nobody's ever going to win this. This is really hard. Several of them are in the medical profession, and they know what's involved. And I said, hang on, wait a minute. I said, the worst business to be in is predicting what science won't figure out next.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Like, I don't know, okay? What I do know is if this is ever discovered, then the universe just got more amazing than we knew before.
That's for sure. That's for sure. And the economic and commercial value of something like this is literally incalculable. It would make the internet look like a small,
yes.
limited idea.
Yes. It
wow.
might make Siri on your iPhone sentient and intelligent. I don't know. but I mean, it's really deep. And you know, and so. This, I felt like this is the untold science of the story of the century. I don't know how this fits into my business. This consumes a huge amount of time. I'm not even going into what a bitch this was to go try to figure out and write about. But I'm telling you, like, people need to know this. The world is amazing. The world is purposeful. The world has its own ability to create and recreate itself. Oh, my goodness. Like, if only people knew.
And the book is Evolution 2.0 by Perry Marshall. I guarantee an enjoyable reading experience. I've got, you know, just huge stacks of books everywhere. Sometimes it's overwhelming. And I said, well, you know, it's Sunday. I got a little time. I'm going to crack this one and see what's going on. The whole Sunday was consumed reading it very pleasantly. And I cannot endorse this book highly enough. And then the website people can go to, again, for...
CosmicFingerprints.com.
cosmicfingerprints.com. Well, yeah. Perry Marshall, you've done it again, except this is a little bit more significant even than Google AdWords. As an understatement, if we never get the answer to this question, at least we've got the right question.
Ken, you talked about having a sense of wonder.
Mm-hmm.
I think that is one of the most precious things that a human being ever has. And for most people, it gets stamped out and institutionalized and beaten out of them. You know, if we could just restore one person's sense of wonder and curiosity and start asking yourself questions again and not being afraid of not knowing the answer, but, you know, isn't there something special about just sitting with a really big question that's so big that it's scary?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, Perry, thanks so much. Again, the book Evolution 2.0, get it, everybody. You're going to have fun. It's great summer reading, great winter reading, whatever season it is. You're going to enjoy the experience of immersing yourself in this most fundamental of existence's questions. This is it. I mean, this is kind of what it all boils down to. And again, this has been a sort of a gray area, a foggy area, an ideologically charged area. How nice it is to liberate it from that and be able to apply our human intelligence to figuring out what actually did all this. So, Perry, thanks a lot. And
thanks for having me.
Oh, you're very welcome.